This is a content warning. This episode will discuss themes involving the Holocaust and suicide. So if you are sensitive to those topics, I recommend skipping this episode. Content warnings, as always, will be in the description when applicable.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Hey, welcome to the party.
Hey, it's really great to be here.
Yeah, so how did you know Soulless 5?
Well, I kind of got into Guitar Hero stuff a little bit later. Got the nostalgia crit, kick. The nostalgia crit in my neck.
That's the one thing I don't want in my neck is Doug Walk.
Oh, no.
So, now that that's out of the way, I don't want to be in this scene anymore.
Yeah.
I elect not to. Soulless 5 is dead. It has been full comboed.
Yes.
By Asai, the famous Clone Hero streamer. So, background for what the hell I just said.
Yes. First off, I want to say, if something soulless dies, does that mean it gains a soul, or...
I think it just has negative soul.
Oh, yeah.
Check out my new ambient noise album, Negative Soul.
I take soul music and I flip it into all negative notes. It's great.
I flip it, which means it sounds exactly the same.
Soulless 5.
No one will
ever know. Okay, Soulless 5. Clone Hero, if you're not aware, is basically just the continuation of Guitar Hero, but like free, like
open source,
yeah,
fan made.
And Soulless is a series of progressively harder and harder songs created by a creator named Exile Lord.
Yes, Exile Lord writes the music and makes the charts for it. Because, just to actually clarify, Clone Hero is specifically made for making charts of other music. It's not like, it doesn't really come bundled with songs. Instead, you have to download charts made by other people. Charts being like, you know, playing the song in Guitar Hero. So it's closer to like Osu in that way, where it's like a fan engine to recreate the game mechanics.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Exile Lord has made the music and made the charts for them. Oftentimes the music is made to facilitate hard patterns. There's actually a few patterns that I think have been named because of Soulless. Like Chimneys, I think, started as a Soulless thing. But so, yeah, they each got harder and harder and harder. Until Soulless 5 released in 2018. It's like, what, a 13-minute song?
17-minute, I believe,
17-minute song. So not only is it hard, but it's a real endurance test.
Yeah.
And nobody had full cleared it, meaning they had hit every note without a miss, until very recently, when Asai started grinding it again. For a while, his PB, his personal best, was 3 notes missed, and then 2 notes missed. Every time he missed the note, it was pretty much in the solo near the end.
Yeah.
The hard part, quote unquote.
The solo that is like 14 minutes in, of course.
Yeah. And, about a week ago or so on stream, he hit it. You can find the VOD on his YouTube. It's kind of incredible. It sort of became a sort of mythical status. Just Soulless 5, you know. Not only is Exile Lord an active member of the community who still makes music and charts, but, like, it's just this chart hadn't been cleared full combo yet for 4 years.
Yeah. It's a chart that's made to be difficult and made to be, like, not impossible to FC, but, like, the top-tier challenge of today. Which, like, most... If I get the vibe correctly, pretty much every Soulless is kind of intended to be, like, the next big challenge, the new boss, if you will.
Yeah, I will say, recently it's been more so that Jarvis songs have been the big things. Jarvis is a chiptune composer who also makes Clone Hero charts of his own music. Or their own music, I don't really know the gender. But Jarvis has songs like Megalodon and... Or is it... I think it's Megalodon. And Prevail, I think, was also Jarvis. A lot of the other, like, really hard charts have come out of Jarvis.
Nice.
But those are also ones that people haven't really grinded as hard on. I think The thing about Soulless, though, is that it sounds really good. It's, like, a pretty good song.
Yeah.
Some parts are a little repetitive, but the main riffs are really catchy, and I often find myself, like, humming some of it.
Yeah, no, I had this insane idea of, like, if I ever do a D&D campaign and also am a billionaire so I don't have to worry about any kind of income ever, to recreate the various chapters of the songs as, like, full songs themselves, use them in a campaign as, like, you know, individual songs and motifs, and then have the final boss just be Soulless 5.
Yeah. Kind of an Undertale style.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you can obviously do that with parts like Pirates, which sounds like a pirate song.
Pirates, Conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Wait, these are just magic sets.
Oh my god.
Where's my Colossal Dreadmaw song, Exile Lord?
Yeah, so Soulless 5 has been conquered, and we are really proud of SIE.
Yeah. Shouts out to him. Father and a gamer. What's so funny?
I don't know why, that just really got me.
I really got you now.
Hey, this is post-production Matt here. Just to say that we made an error here. Asai was not the first person to FC Soulless 5. He was the third, the other two being Friff and Carney Jared. Asai has the highest score currently, but he is only the third person, which is still very impressive and exciting.
So yeah, we're talking about music today, and specifically one album that is pretty notorious in some circles. It is sort of the face of, let's just get into Mew.
Yeah, Mew. Okay. So 4chan.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Quick rundown of 4chan. Go on.
Okay. 4chan is a derivative of 2chan, which is an anonymous message board from Japan. 4chan was created with in America, generally mm-hmm. with America in mind.
Yep.
It's kind of the birthplace of a lot of early internet memes, and honestly the birthplace of a lot of later internet memes as well. It's sort of notorious for being this really toxic place. Just like, at the very least, the B boards and the poll boards certainly are extremely notorious. But we're not going to talk about them.
Polls should just be stricken from the universe.
Yes. But we're not going to talk about them. We're going to talk about Mew, which is specifically the music anonymous message board.
Yes, Mew for music. And so Mew being a place in 4chan to talk about music, they sort of have a canon, if you will. Sort of in the sense that there's, like, the Western canon of books that people say, hey, these are good books, you should read them. Mew has its own what they call Mewcore. It's not really a genre so much as it is, like, recommended listening. Albums that are generally considered good by the community in some degree. Probably also a lot of it is just how frequently it gets talked about.
Yeah.
The album we're talking about today is currently, or it's commonly, like, the Mewcore album. Like, if you find a Mewcore list or chart, that's probably the first one on there. I want to note, though, so I've kind of noticed a pattern with a lot of their favorites. See if you can get it. You also might have not heard of these albums, because it's very hipstery of a board.
Yes.
That's one of the big things, is they're very hipstery. So there's the album today, there's Kid A by Radiohead, In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy by Kanye, The Money Store by Death Grips, Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart's Lovely Jazz Band, is that what it's called? Captain Beefheart, I guess is the name of it. Lift Your Skinny Fists Like Antennas Towards the Heavens by Godspeed You Black Emperor, Twin Fantasy by Car Seat Headrest. Okay, so
I haven't heard of most of these.
Okay, so there are a few main themes. One of them is they really like post-rock and distortion and shoegaze. Some of the other ones are like Animal Collective, My Bloody Valentine. These are a lot of bands that have heavy distortion, very long sort of droning guitars, very atmospheric, not as much rhythmic or melodic, if that makes sense. Very emotional music. They like emotion, especially men with emotion.
Yeah.
These are predominantly male-led bands, and I don't know if that's a pattern that's like, once you get into some of the other stuff, it definitely appears more. You have things like Bjork. But a lot of their top stuff is.
Yeah. Not to make a specific assertion because it is fully anonymous, but generally speaking, 4chan appeals to men more, I believe.
Generally.
Yeah. At the very least, like in its earlier days and its development up until now, it certainly did. Like that's kind of one of the really big things about 4chan is that it specifically appealed to men.
Yeah. But things like Twin Fantasy by Carseat Headrest. What's it called? Kid A. Like, those are very emotionally vulnerable band albums with men as the lead.
Yeah. And even today.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah. The album we're talking about today is also generally very emotional and very male-led.
And very distorted. They also like sort of genre trendsetters, things that are ahead of their time. The album today, Court of the Crimson King, famous like post-rock, like... I guess it's like early prog, really, not post prog. You know, MBDTF is the Kanye album that kind of set the scene for the rest of that decade. The Money Store is kind of ahead of its time at the time. And you're only now starting to really see Death Grips influence on a lot of artists. Trout Mask Replica is bad. But that's the other thing, is they're hard to listen to.
Yes.
This is the biggest thing I noticed with MuCore, is that they really like albums that are traditionally hard to listen to. Some of the, like, American Football, I don't think is that hard to listen to, but it's math rock, and there are people that don't like math rock, because it's, like, kind of chaotic at times. You know, Since I Left You is usually pretty high, but not super high. Maybe the only, like, popular thing they have high up usually is, what's it called? Remain in Light by Talking Heads, which is, you know, it's Talking Heads. It's the album with Once in a Lifetime, but it's still kind of, you know, avant-garde in a lot of the other songs.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that's super interesting. It almost feels just more of a hipster thing. Like, oh, you can't listen to this music? That's because you're a normie. You know, it's hard for me to not prescribe that.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of snobbery that goes on with it, that goes on with 4chan in general, but also with Mew.
And
we in general do not like, we do not endorse cringe culture, in that, you know, if you like things genuinely, like them. And if you like something that is hard to listen to, cool. I like ska music.
Yeah, I love ska music, and, like, people do say it's hard to listen to, and I'm like, I guess it's fair.
But, like, the MuCore playlist generally has a lot of things that are, like, very much, at the very least, fit that stereotype of, like, I only listen to... You know, I only listen to, like, slowed down, high reverb washing machine noises in 6/7 time.
Yeah. I listened to one person strumming a guitar, and then they, like, slowed it down and reversed it.
I listen to only the entire movie The Wizard of Oz, slowed down, reversed, sped up, and then fast forwarded.
Put through a low pass filter, a high pass filter, a no pass filter, a saw filter, a literal saw that they used to cut up the disc and then play it back.
And then interpreted by an ASL learner, and then reinterpreted into music.
That's basically how Trout Mask Replica was made. Which, yeah, I think that's the epitome of it in some ways, is because it's an album made by somebody who doesn't know how to compose music. And it's just, like, I can respect the way the album was made, and I can respect the album as a work of art, but it is very much not a listenable experience the same way, like, you know, a pop album is.
One of my favorite literary jokes, and let me be clear, let me be clear, I'm also being an asshole here. One of my favorite literary jokes is Kilgore Trout, the character who appears in multiple works by Kurt Vonnegut, whereby the joke is essentially that he's made a whole bunch of sci-fi novels that sound interesting with a one-sentence descriptor, because every sci-fi novel sounds interesting if you have a one-sentence descriptor, but actually reading it is a fucking slog.
Especially Kurt Vonnegut.
Indeed.
Ice that freezes everything.
But yeah,
boy, where can I sign up?
And so, like, the respect of the artistry versus the actual listenability is certainly a a divide that, you know, you can have, especially with sort of like high concept albums like the ones that tend to show up on Mew.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, I'm not saying unlistenable in a derogatory sense. I mean, I love Giraffes, and they're very hard to listen to sometimes. I can respect challenging music or music that fits a certain mood that is not a very common mood for music listening.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of these albums sound better high.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know.
Giraffes. Is that the giraffe stick?
Yeah.
No. Anyway.
Yeah, so yeah, it's to say that there's sort of a lot of these common themes regarding the music Mew likes. If you want to get on Mew's good list, listen to all those and then be like, yes, I can make it the perfect album. But, of course, the album today is, like, iconic for Mew, and sort of just for the internet. It's gained a very big cult following. So we're talking about In the Airplane Over the Sea. Sorry, In the Aeroplane Over the Sea.
Yes.
By Neutral Milk Hotel.
The Fact Corner.
Neutral Milk Hotel is a band founded by frontman Jeff Magnum. They founded in, I believe, 95. Or they formed in 95. Made one album. And then this album today is their second album, their second release. It was largely done by Jeff Magnum and their producer, Robert Schneider. Not to be confused with the other Rob Schneider.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything.
Yeah. Jeff Magnum did the songwriting, the composing, the lyricism, all that. And then Robert Schneider was the one who sort of developed a lot of the techniques used in production that led to the very distinct distortion along the album. A lot of mixing of digital and analog recording, a lot of different types of filters and pedals, you name it.
Yeah.
And that's really sort of the sort of like musical style. It's really hard to pin down a genre beyond indie rock because it really bounces between like dirges, folk, some like punk, some more just kind of rock, alt, indie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It goes from, like, guy with guitar to guy with guitar in band to, like, hardcore fucking, like, awesome shredding to, like, distortion noise.
Yeah.
That is completely unlistenable.
It's like psychedelic. There's some early forms of shoegaze in there. There's a lot, stylistically. But pretty much all of it is distorted in some way. Usually a lot of compression is used.
Yeah. So usually when we talk about albums, I think we kind of give the disclaimer of like, you should listen to this beforehand. And generally speaking, it'll help to understand what we're talking about if we're going to talk about this. I think we're probably going to get song by song recommendations though. Cause yeah. Like there are definitely some that I would be like, yeah, this is a really fucking good song you should listen to. And then some I would be like, you know, if you just sort of skipped this one.
Yeah, so I would definitely say if you want to listen, like, I would recommend listening to the album through at least once.
Yes.
You don't have to listen through it more than once if you really don't want to. I mean, don't have to listen to it all the way through at all. We're not
your parent.
Yeah. So, do what you will with that.
It is 40 minutes, which, you know, isn't, I think that's the shortest album we've talked about, basically.
Maybe. I'm not super... that'd be interesting to figure out.
Yeah.
I feel like Floral Shop was shorter, but maybe only in, like, the first version of it.
Because
that album had patches.
Yeah, we had... I think we talked about, like, the full special edition album, basically.
Yeah. So, Floral Shop, another Mew, favorite.
Yeah.
So, the album released in 1998, Aeroplane Over the Sea, and afterwards... the band got a lot more attention following the reception of it, and the frontman Jeff Magnum really just couldn't handle the pressure, so he became pretty reclusive and didn't want to talk to media too much, and the band broke up since. So this is their second album and their last album they produced.
Unfortunate, but also, isn't that kind of also its own poetic sort of, sort of thing?
I want to give... two big content warnings before we go into the actual album.
Yes.
I'll also put these at the start of the episode and in the description. The two content warnings are discussion of suicide and discussion of the Holocaust. Yes.
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 Okay. So, In the Airplane Over the Sea. Well, I want to just start off by saying, Jeff Magnum is not the best singer.
Yes.
I will just start with that. Like, yes, that's kind of, yeah, it's kind of hard to listen to. It's kind of the point. Like, I don't want to say you shouldn't listen to it because he's a bad singer or anything, but like, I understand that his voice is really grating. I think it does have an element of emotion to it.
Yeah.
Sort of rawness. He almost sounds like screaming or crying at times, which fits the emotion of the album.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it starts with King of Carrot Flowers Part 1. And I kind of love this because it's a very calm, chill, kind of unassuming song at first. It opens with a tarot card reading. The King, the Tower, and Rattlesnakes, or Snake. So, you know, you've got two major arcana and then a snake.
It's fucking beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I had not actually noticed that.
Yeah, I didn't really notice it either until looking through the lyrics and somebody mentioned that. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's really clever.
So King of Carrot Flowers Part 1, I think, can lull you into a certain sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
That will, like, pretty soon be subverted. It's certainly not the most well-known King of Carrot Flowers part. But, like, listening to it, I'd always assumed Part 2 was the actual opener, only knowing this through basically meme status. King of Carrot Flowers Part 1 is, like, super my style of music.
Yeah.
Like, to a absolutely insane degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it is just a really, really good song.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's unassuming.
Yeah.
Yeah. The lyrics talk about two people having sex.
Yeah.
I want to mention that the depictions of sex in this album are very messy and tender and raw and kind of whimsical.
Yes, yes.
But
okay.
There's a lot of like very like I don't know, it's not romanticized all the time. Or it's romanticized in a weird way.
So okay. And I'm going to probably end up talking about this in later songs as well.
Mm-hmm.
The version of, like, the style in which the songs discuss sex, it's very sensual in many aspects. Like, in this song, I think it's, like, it's something like seeing what each other's bodies were for.
Yeah.
Like, that is a very sexual lyric, but, like, it's not exactly sexualized. Like,
right.
It is a very, like, this is two innocent people discovering their bodies.
Right.
And, like, that is shown and sort of discussed as a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, later on, it also does kind of discuss sex as, like, this weird, fleshy, kind of slightly gross thing. But it doesn't, I don't think it ever loses, like, the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Like, it discusses sex as something both really gross, but also, like, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it does that more in later songs, but, like, the very first song, like, really sets up the sort of beauty of it, I mm-hmm. think.
Yeah. It also depicts a domestic relationship of domestic abuse.
Yes.
Between the mom and the dad, as they're known in the album. Like, stabbing someone with a fork and throwing garbage across the floor.
Yeah.
It's not pretty.
I don't know if it's supposed to be quite literal, but, like, it is definitely supposed to be, like, you have a terrible home life.
Yeah.
This is a terrible, terrible home life that... Okay, here's my take of just specifically this song in a bottle. It seems to give the vibe to me of, like, having a terrible home life but still being nostalgic for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is clearly not good, but you can't help but still feel a certain sadness that of the days gone.
Yeah. A lot of the album has to deal with these sort of conflicting emotions and conflicting states of being. In this case, there's, like, the young and the old, the alive and not quite dead, but the dying.
Yeah.
The tender and the mad and, you know, broken. And all of that is talked about with very similar tone.
Yeah.
Which is what's interesting to me. That these are things that happened and, you know, they might be described with different words. You know, the sex is more poetic and the domestic abuse is more literal. But, like, at the same time, they're both present with the same notes, the same chords in the song.
Yeah.
Part 2 of King of Carrot Flowers, I Love You, Jesus Christ.
I Love You, Jesus Christ.
That's it.
Jesus Christ, I love you.
Yes, I do. I can't remember where I read this, but I'm pretty sure I read an interview that Jeff gave where he said, like, I don't really care for what Christians do in the name of Christ, but Jesus as a person was pretty cool. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty true, honestly.
Yeah,
that's you ever good... actually read what he did? He one time just, like, shat on a bunch of people trading money in the church steps. It's like, you don't need to be greedy about the church, you know?
Jesus Christ is...
He was friends with a hooker.
Yeah, Jesus Christ was a radical socialist who hung out with the lower class, with prostitutes, with fishermen. And
with
who,
the disabled.
Yeah, with the disabled, and who actively said that, like, being rich and a Christian is bad.
Yeah, you ever try to pass through the eye of a needle?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jeff Bezos, and welcome to The Needle Travel. We're going to send you through the eye of a needle.
Yo, what's up, YouTube? It's The Needle Challenge. Today, I brought three of my best friends, and we are going to travel through the eye of a needle. Just hit the like and bell subscribe button. Check out our merch store over at merchstore.store.merch.co.uk.
So, King of Pirate Flowers Part 2 and 3.
Yeah. So that's just Part 2. Part 3, I really like.
Yes.
I hate that I have to go through Part 2 to listen to Part 3. But I'm quite a fan of Part 3. It's very fast-paced and pretty, like, upbeat. It's about, like, facing adversity.
This is I think the first part where, like, the just absolute peaking, really, like, chaotic music starts, but this is also, like, one of the more comforting ones.
Yeah.
Like, this is, like you said, it's more about facing diversity than,
well,
like...
adversity.
Adversity, sorry. Facing I'm not going to start riffing on that joke. Facing diversity. The only thing I say when facing diversity is...
Hi.
Yes. Is cool.
Welcome.
It starts... to get really discordant, but it doesn't, like, it disorients you, but it isn't unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not the unlistenable part to me, personally.
I like the lyrics. It's like, I will float till I learn how to swim.
Yes.
I will spit till I learn how to speak. Like, I am just going to push through until I actually get what I want to do, because you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And I will do that.
It is... It is very, very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Next is In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, the titular track.
Yep.
Which is a pretty pleasant love song about how fleeting life is, so you have to enjoy it with what you can. There's the mention of this place that is circling all around the sun. That's a motif that will come back later. The circling around the sun. There's a lot of references to death. You know, like the scattering ashes out of the airplane. There is someone giving someone CPR. Though, here's the thing. So it's like, how I remember how I moved my, or pushed my fingers through your mouth and made those muscles move. It sounds like a kink.
Yes. Yes.
And so, but it also is like CPR, you know?
Yeah.
To like use fingers to open somebody's mouth and then give them CPR to move their, you know, their lungs. And so it's this interesting sort of dualism.
Yeah, which is also something that, like, kind of comes up, is there's a lot of, like, double entendre that can be sexual and also can be not.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's just what the description of double entendre is, but...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to be... I don't want to be generic. I don't want to be... your generic, like, huh, this guy must have been on drugs. But as someone who, for legal purposes, has never experimented with drugs and is only speaking with my experience that other people have told me what drugs are like, because drugs are not yet legal in Missouri. Being high is very stream of consciousness, but everything makes sense. Like, everything always makes sense within the moment. And like, this song gives me those vibes. I don't want to be the generic person who says, whoa, they must have been on drugs. But, like, that the vibe that it gives is this kind of, like, self-actualized presence,
mm-hmm.
that like every lyric is extremely deliberate in that moment.
It reads like a diary.
Yes.
Like a diary where you're just writing what comes to mind. Very stream of consciousness. The lyrics are often considered like very surreal, and they do jump from topic to topic very quickly. That makes it hard to really draw down a continuous like stream of thought or its main topic for a verse. It's more like a lot of smaller topics squeezed together in a way that is very cramped and at the same time is trying to be a bigger picture than one piece.
Yeah.
I love, so the final verse is about the singer eventually dying themselves and meeting others on a cloud and laughing. There's a lot of references to the afterlife in this album, which I think is pretty interesting. The number of ways it's presented. It's a pretty spiritual album. It doesn't really, other than Jesus Christ, it doesn't really present a, like, faith-based system, if you will.
Yeah.
But it does talk about spiritual themes of, like, afterlife, rebirth, yeah. stuff like that.
It's a spiritual album, but not a religious one, and I mean that in a genuine way.
Yeah. I also just love the last line, how strange it is to be anything at all.
It's really good.
It's really good, a little, like, kind of generically cliched in terms of existentialism, but still.
Well, here's another thing, because there's a later song that begins with, like, essentially crying to daddy. It's like, it basically starts with, like, oh, daddy, why didn't you love me? It's not literally that, but, like, and I kind of had that thought of, like, man, this is so, like, this is so indie album. Mm-hmm. This is, like, the exact thing that, like, you know, indie artists and this kind of music gets made fun of for. But this is also 98. Like, this is cutting edge of that.
Mm-hmm.
It, to an extent. Like, not that people weren't complaining about their dads before, but, like,
this is when that guard was still avant.
Yes, exactly.
The edge was still cutting.
I do have one criticism, which is that the discordant, like, I think they're violins near the end. I hate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that, like, especially with later songs, there is points where, like, the discordance is supposed to be the point in many examples.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, there's a difference between discord and unlistenable.
Yeah.
To me personally. And the violins really start to teeter over to the edge too. I'm just gonna skip to the next song.
Mm-hmm. Next song is Two-Headed Boy, which is one that I think is also kind of unassuming if you were to listen to it out of context.
Yes.
It's like one of the least distorted songs in the album.
Yes.
It has a slightly more conventional structure as well, kind of. It has like three or four verses, but you know. It's a really complicated album lyric-wise, because like it has sort of a literal aspect of a boy with two heads stuck in a jar trying to communicate with the outside world. I personally view that as somebody who is, like, having trouble communicating themselves and so is looking for a way to express it.
Yeah.
This is shown through creative means of, like, dancing along with a accordion piece or accordion keys, you know, accordion music.
Yeah.
And building a radio, which, you know, you can play music out of, or it could be like a walkie-talkie radio.
I like the allusion to dance because I think it kind of adds to the stream of consciousness, since like dance is essentially just the physical expression of self.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Dance is the physical expression of self.
Mm-hmm. Also, All Floating in Glass, I actually did not, when I heard that lyric, I interpreted that as like being in a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Like Two-Headed Boy is not literally a boy with two heads, but somebody who is looking at themselves in a mirror, and like it's I interpreted this song in some way to be a discussion with yourself.
Yeah.
To sort of add to that themes of loneliness.
Mm-hmm. My vision of the Two-Headed Boy was it is somebody with two sides. One side that is, like, the inner side, and then the other side that's the outer side.
Yeah.
The outer side is colder and distant in grief, but the inner side is the one that wants to be expressed. The yeah. one that is trying to tap on the jar. The jar being the jar of the mind. The jar of the heart. The jar of the soul. Not any other jar. We don't talk about other jars.
Yeah, there's no other jars in this album.
The jar could be, like, a casket. The singer trying to find any semblance of the boy being alive.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is also where, more sort of like sensual lyrics, this is kind of where I actually have the note about sensuality, yeah. About, taking off our clothes and placing fingers through the notches in your spine,
mm-hmm.
which is like a real, like, it feels sensual and sexual, but it also feels like weird.
It's literal.
Yeah.
Who says notches in your spine in a sexy way?
Yeah.
Name something that a man would like about a woman. Notches in her spine.
Survey says it's on the board.
That was Jeff Magnum in the audience. I was in the survey. Yeah, no, it's very interesting because it's hard for me to tell that he's saying they'll place fingers through the notches in your spine. It sounds like wheel or I'll, something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the official lyric is they'll, and it's sort of impersonalized. Like, you think it's going to be its intimate moment in the dark, but it's actually like, you know, somebody being inspected or exhumed or something.
Yeah, it brings to mind more like a vivisection.
Yeah.
Almost. Although there is an important distinction to be made between dissection and vivisection. Sorry, that's a reference to anatomy. Anyway. So yeah, Anne Frank. I clicked on a lyric randomly, I believe in the last song. No, it was this one. It was this one. I clicked on the line in the parlor with a moon across her face and saw Anne Frank's name. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe I should actually be reading along what these what the themes are supposed to be.
So I had told Galen to listen to this once before looking anything up and then look stuff up. Because it's kind of a cognito hazard.
Yeah.
To listen to the lyrics with this forbidden knowledge. So, okay, so there's two major events that happened before this album that led to a lot of the lyrics and themes present. One of them is Jeff Magnum read The Diary of Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Or is it Young Woman?
I'm not sure. I personally have never actually read it.
Okay. And he was, like, obsessed with it, almost. He said he cried for, like, 3 days straight. He kept having dreams of going back in time to save her. Of course, this got out to 4chan. Somebody found what they said was a yearbook of Jeff's class with a girl that looked like Anne Frank, but it was probably Photoshopped because it's 4chan.
Yeah.
It became sort of part of the mythos surrounding the album. It's like, oh, it's about Anne Frank. And there's definitely a lot of lines that do relate to that. And I think the notches in your spine is a really clever example, because it could be like the spine of a book.
Yeah.
That people are reading the book, which is her spine, placing the fingers through the notches or the pages.
That is a really like galaxy brain take that I really enjoy.
Yeah. And apparently there's like arguments about how much of the album is actually about Anne Frank. One camp says it's more of a concept album solely about her. Another says it's just an inspiration that is one of many. Yeah. I'm in the latter half that I think it's an important part that is definitely present in a lot of the lines, but I don't think every line is related to her.
Yeah. Like, Holland 1945 is certainly, like, it's a song that comes up later that certainly has a lot of specific allusion to her, but, like, to say this is an Anne Frank concept album, I feel like is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I won't say it's wrong, but like you said, it very much is a theme that comes up, but is not like wholly about it. I have a take a little bit later with it that we'll get to, but like, yeah, I don't think that this song is literally about getting a time machine and going back to save Anne Frank.
Right. So the end of Two-Headed Boy is sort of this like crying sort of wail, weep.
Yeah.
And then it goes into The Fool, which is an instrumental track. Another tarot card, The Fool.
Yes.
Sort of like a funeral waltz.
Yeah.
It has bagpipes.
It's a funeral waltz mixed with a marching band. Insert obvious joke.
When I was
a young boy. That's
a concept album.
It is a concept album, and it's also literally the second note that I have is When I Was a Young Boy.
Mm-hmm.
But no. So this is another part where, like, it is heavily discordant, but I feel like in this song it works better for me.
Yeah.
Because, like, like we said, it's sort of like a funeral dirge x marching band style. And so, like, it reads to me like to, you know, be about the chaos of death.
Yeah. In the chaos of mourning.
Yeah.
Next up is Holland 1945, which is my favorite song. It is very compressed. It reminds me of, like, a bass boosted meme, like, where the speakers cannot physically handle the audio.
Yeah.
I really like it. So the first verse is definitely about Anne Frank.
Yes.
They buried her alive one evening, 1945, with just her sister at her side. And only weeks before the guns came and rained on So, like, you know, she died weeks before the camp was liberated, the concentration camp she was in.
Yeah.
Which is very sad. But then it presents a sort of reincarnation, that Anne Frank was reborn in another life as a pianist playing a piano with passion. A sort of, like, you know, in another life she is able to be expressive and self-actualized.
Yeah.
This is also, like, where more of that sort of spinning comes in, sort of the circle of life or the rotation of the universe. There's empty rings around the sun, and there's now we ride the circus wheel, sort of a more karmic wheel, not just the objective, the earth is spinning around the sun.
Yeah. This is definitely where, like, the sort of literal aspects of the, of the Anne Frank inspiration.
Yeah, sure.
This is where, like, the literal aspects of the Anne Frank inspiration come in, but I also feel like it is using the literal story, but it can also kind of read it as a personal story. Like, it is literally about picking up the rubble after a mass tragedy, but you can easily kind of, like, infer a certain personal story of that, of, like, picking up the rubble after a personal tragedy as well.
Right. So this is where the other major event comes in, is that prior to this album's recording, the brother of one of Jeff's friends committed suicide. And that is present in this song with the second verse, the dark brother asking why, says it was good to be alive, but now he rides upon a flame. All that. That is presenting the brother of his friend and saying, like, you know, we have to be able to move on from this in some way.
Yeah.
It clearly affected Jeff Magnum very personally as well, because, I mean, it's present in so many of these songs.
Yeah.
This is sort of a way for him to help move forward as well. Help himself move forward. I do love the Earth looks better from the star that's right above from where you are. Sort of like, from a distance, Earth looks better, which also fitting with the sort of afterlife that has been present throughout the album. It's like saying, you know, it's gonna look better to somebody who's dead. They don't have to worry about the struggles of the Earth.
Yeah. I also kind of feel like that could also be sort of a reference to the Diary of Anne Frank, in that, mm-hmm. like, you know, it looks better when you have a sort of, like, farther away view of the world,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. And then, yeah, the final verse brings back more of the Anne Frank with, like, the indentions in the sheets where their bodies once moved.
Yeah.
It's literally in the Anne Frank house. You can see the bed sheets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next is Communist Daughter.
Which is a very good song.
Very good song. One of the memeiest songs on the album. Semen Stains the Mountaintops.
Yeah, Semen Stains the Mountaintops. I want to read you a real annotation.
On Genius?
Yes, yeah. On Genius. And I don't want to make fun of it. Because, like, I do not want to make fun of people for, like, looking into these songs. We are literally doing the same thing right now. But I just want to give you, like, a sort of benchmark of, like, the level that I was, like, trying to be on when thinking about this song. And then seeing this and going, oh, man, I'm way out of my depth, huh? The representation of semen staining mountaintops perfectly illustrates the concept of androcentrism, which stems from an ecofeminist perspective of anthropocentrism. Simply put, the semen-stained peaks represent the influence of male domination in society on women and aspects of the environment. Like, that's what music critics do. We're just two assholes with a podcast.
I mean, to me, it's the C on the T's, if you know what I mean. That's the mountaintops. Fucking Twin Peaks, brother. Hell yeah. Fist bump.
Fist bump.
Hell yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I get the point behind that for sure.
Yeah. It's another, like, I think the continuation was essentially, like, the destruction of innocence and that anything can be perverted.
Yeah.
Like, even snow on a mountain, which is just sort of objectively beautiful, can be perverted to be like, hey, it looks like cum, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's the toxic innuendo.
Yeah.
And then the last verse in it deals with masturbation.
Yes. Oh my god. the specific line, she moves herself about her fist.
Mm-hmm.
That is so good. Like, that is such a good fucking poetic line about masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it begins with a one. Even in, like, the most, like, I am coming down here to be something of a music snob myself and interpret these things in a poetic manner. Every once in a while, I run into something that I hear and I go, oh, shut the fuck up. And that one did it for me. I don't know why. I was just like, you don't get to just say one.
It's the House of Leaves checkmark. Okay, next is O Comely, which is the longest song in the album at like 8 minutes.
It is 8 minutes long.
It's very complex, pretty, like, dour.
Yeah. It's sort of like a song about death and perversion. Like,
it's about a lot.
It's deeply personal and deeply complex.
Yeah. There's a description of a happy memory that wasn't as exciting in real life as it was in memory. There's a verse about needing comfort from friends, but the singer not being able to provide, only painting himself as an enemy.
Yeah.
The chorus is the singer saying, like, you know, I will not love you even when you try to sweet talk me, essentially, to paraphrase.
This also, I feel like, explores the darker side of sexuality, but it doesn't lose, like, it doesn't lose the beauty of sex, but it explores how it can be bad. Like, it discusses, like, essentially the father cheating on the mother, in, like, a really grotesque way, like, the father creating fetuses while the mother is away or something like
that. While the mother's sleeping in a trailer park.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that like, difficult marriage from that first song brought back, and now the daughter in this scenario is turning to music as a form of expression.
Yeah.
And then there's a ton of innuendo with pistons.
Yeah.
and a garden.
Okay. Here's I think one of my big takes. So the line, will she remember me 50 years later? I wished I could have saved her in some sort of time machine. Firstly, funny.
The most overt line.
Yeah. But I really like the line, will she remember me 50 years later?
Because
I feel like one big theme of this album, and this probably isn't a hot take, is essentially like the terrifying sadness of never being able to meet your heroes. Like the unfortunate state of, you know, this random girl who was suddenly thrust to popularity far posthumously after her death. And so, like, she is a massive figurehead. She is, like, one of the first, like, Holocaust victims you think of, like, when you think of people who died in the Holocaust. And that is, like, on one hand, that is a great, great thing. Like, we need to have that connection to the actual people who were the victims of these terrible tragedies. But at the same time, like, you know, if you got to heaven or the afterlife, whatever the afterlife is, and met Anne Frank and said, oh my god, your diary, like, absolutely, like, you know, I am such a, you know, it impacted me so much, she would have no idea who you are.
She would be like, why are you reading my diary?
Yeah.
That's my diary. You know what a diary is?
Yeah. It said diary. What do you mean you mass printed it?
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, it's definitely this one-sided view of, like, you know, I'm so captivated by this person who was died 50 years before, you know, writing this song or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's that, like, I feel like I have a personal connection, but I literally cannot and do not.
Yeah.
Parasocial, almost, to use a sort of current word.
In modern context, it would definitely be, like, the terrifying ordeal of a parasocial relationship, but
yeah,
even then it's like not exactly one-to-one because it's a posthumous parasocial relationship.
It's even like, if he were to go back in time simply to save her life, would she remember that act 50 years into the future?
Yeah.
Would she see Jeff Magnum and be like, you were the time man?
Yeah. There's all okay, I want to probably put in the most controversial part of this, which is that I will also not hear any. I do not know Jeff Magnum. Mm-hmm. I do not know him as a person. However, sexuality, from my understanding, is like a really big part of Anne Frank's diary. Is like her exploration of sexuality that gets censored a lot,
mm-hmm.
like that gets completely stricken from the record. So like, I will have zero, like, discussion of, like, is this man a secret pedophile because he's talking about sex in the context of Anne Frank? Like, art transcends certain things.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're not going to even entertain that kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know the man himself, but at the very least, based on this work, we can't say what the man is.
Yeah. It's definitely different in that he never talks directly about Anne Frank with that sort of language.
Yeah.
And in fact, I feel like the person he does talk about is this lover with the troubled marriage, or the troubled parents.
Yeah.
But they have traits that are completely anachronistic to, you know, the Holocaust.
Yeah. The discussion of sexuality is between, like, the two-headed boy, the parents, sort of like the unnamed lover that, like, has allusions to Anne Frank, but, like,
isn't
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The song ends with just sort of a slow send-off and then a band member saying, holy shit.
Yes.
Because Jeff recorded this in one take, which is wild.
Like, that's my favorite little trivia, is that there's a literal quiet holy shit. Because this is a one-take song.
And he did it in one take, and it's just, yeah, it's surprising. I respect that.
Oh,
even though,
man,
I'm not the biggest fan of the song itself.
Yeah.
I really respect the skill required in there. So, next song is Ghost, which is kind of a mixed bag for me. So, in an interview with Puncture Magazine, Jeff stated that the idea started with a ghost living in his house. The idea that a ghost could be there. And so it almost, like, summons the ghost with a seance.
Yeah.
What the chorus has, like, never be afraid to watch the morning paper blow, which sounds like a very average occurrence. Like, it sounds like never be afraid to just live through an average life, a boring life, one where you get the paper in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's kind of windy, so it blows. But then it says, into a hole where no one can escape. I want to contrast that with the line in King of Carrot Flowers Part 1, into that sacred place where no one dares to go.
Oh, yeah.
So, the no one dares to go is the sexual innuendo part. You can fill in the blanks yourself, listener. But also,
blanks.
It could sort of just be the soul, the literal soul, because that's what it's described as in King of Carrot Flowers. And so, if the paper is going into the literal soul of someone, it's like displaying their innermost thoughts. No one can escape the paper because it immortalizes the text.
Yeah.
You know, history is told through books in this regard, through text. The paper tells of big events. So you could think of it either as literal, the diary of Anne Frank, or just like the newspaper. Like, all those events happening are just you know, headlines.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't be afraid of the headlines appearing.
The only real note I have is the line, "And she was born in a bottle rocket in 1929 with wings that ringed around a socket right between her spine," is really good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of the only real note I have. This is just sort of a bop to me.
Yeah.
I quite love Ghosts, and it builds to a climax near the end that, like, is very good and is not, like, too distorted for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that line because the motif of the spine comes up a lot. We mentioned the spine in Two-Headed Boy. Now it's presented with wings, which are, you know, white, long sheets of something poking from a spine.
Yeah.
I wonder what that could be. Leaves, perhaps, in some sort of domicile. We'll have to just do that book sometime. I don't know. That comes up in the last song as well. Just adding wings to it also is like, you know, an angel.
Yeah.
It seems like the people who placed their fingers through the notches in the spine added the wings, maybe. Was it like God creating an angel out of Anne Frank or whoever this unnamed person is?
Yeah, it interrogates the idea of, you know, what do we place the importance on her, or was she truly important?
Yeah.
Also, I would just like to say that a person with wings that reigned around the socket right between her spine can do anything, but a person born in a bottle rocket in 1929 can do everything.
Nice. Epic reference. Three people will get that, and I'm one of them. All right. Second to last track is Untitled, which is pure distorted multi-instrumental noise.
It's a panic attack for 2.5 minutes, and I hate it.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind it a whole lot, but yeah, it's definitely the most hardest to listen to track on the album.
Yeah.
The most track on the album.
Of all tracks on the album, this is one.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a sort of climax as far as the, like, instruments go, but I think the real climax to the lyrics is the final song, Two-Headed Boy Part 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two-Headed Boy Part 2 brings back all the themes and motifs. The first verse has the dysfunctional family with the daughter asking the father for comfort, you know, asking him to remember his own childhood to sort of, you know, bring back that. Then there's the wings in the spine. The line of, like, love to be with a brother of mine, I think, is, like, Jeff hoping Anne Frank meets the dark brother. Or yeah. Just that, you know, the dark brother can find some solace in the afterlife.
Yeah, I think I had the note specifically that, like, the idea of brother could harken back to the idea of mirror I had before, with the line, brother, we are one and the same.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. There is, there's the roses in her eyes from Holland 1945. Which was sort of a, sort of just, like, a way of poetically representing just, like, the life in someone's eyes.
Yeah.
The lights in the life. White roses.
This also has the line of, Daddy, please hear the song I sing that I mentioned earlier. Of, yeah. Like, the kind of trope of, like, singing to your dad.
Right.
Which, again, I want to reiterate, I am not making fun of, like, don't make fun of people for being emotionally vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm merely just kind of stating that, like, that is the kind of thing I have seen, like, people make fun of indie music for.
Mm-hmm. Narratively, it follows that is being said by the daughter of the father.
Yeah.
Because in O Comely, I believe, she started turning to music as a way to express herself.
Yeah.
There is a verse that is much more graphic about the suicide and yeah. Saying, like, I'd rather remember this person with, you know, a good smile and all that rather than the negative. I love this line, God is a place where some holy spectacle lies. God is a place where you'll wait for the rest of your life. I kind of love that. It's interesting because, like, God is a place, not a person. In this line.
Yeah.
And in some ways, there's a lot of ways that can be interpreted. I feel like there's the obvious spiritual of, like, heaven that keeps being presented, you know, stars and clouds and stuff. Also, it's, like, memory. A lot of this is about just, like, remembering people, a lot of the album.
Yeah.
And so, It's like, you know, maybe God is the memory of somebody. It's the place where some holy spectacle lies, that spectacle being the idea that humans can remember things and process thoughts,
yeah,
and ideas.
My favorite interpretations of God in various artistic pieces is that God is not a person, but God is actions you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God is not a literal person sitting on a mountaintop. God is the person who, like, God is, you know, someone acting in good faith for a good reason. And yeah. So, like, it really, I really, really like the interpretation of, like you said, God as a place. God is us, mm-hmm. ostensibly.
God could be a book, again, remembering people who have passed.
Yeah. What if God was one of us?
Just a stranger on a bus. God is a girl, though. The outro of the song reprises the main rhythm and melody of Two-Headed Boy. She feeds tomatoes and radio wires is a great line. It sounds like kind of duplicitous. The scandalous and duplicitous girlfriend, Carissa. it sounds like that, but it's also like you remember the Two-Headed Boy was making a radio to, like, communicate, and so it's like she is helping the Two-Headed Boy by giving him radio wires to construct a radio.
Yeah.
And then finally, there it ends with the line, "Don't hate her when she gets up to leave." And I feel like this is the, it's such a good capstone. Because throughout the whole album, it's been, like, nostalgia, memory, longing to have met this person who died long ago. And I think this is just, it's not only letting go of a relationship, it's letting go of these things in the past you're too obsessed with.
Yeah.
Like, "She Gets Up to Leave" is both, you know, somebody leaving a relationship because it's not healthy, which appears a few times. Or leaving a relationship because they're not getting enough out of it. Maybe that it's too focused on sex or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or it's just you have to move on from a loss.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in this case, Anne Frank, she has to get out of your head at some point in that you can't be so obsessed with her.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, it's like there's times to move on from grief, I guess.
Yeah.
You'll never truly move on, but it's not like moving past it forgets it either. You shouldn't hate the act of, you know, moving forward from your losses.
Yeah, the impact of Anne Frank, the impact of the story of Anne Frank, the impact of, you know, the brother's suicide, the impact of just the Two-Headed Boy and the girl, like, it will never be forgotten, but it will also never be, like, a part of you for the rest of life. Mm-hmm. Like, it has to, there is an endpoint to everything, and so you have to learn to let things just kind of end.
I think it's very poetic in a weird way that's kind of morbid that the band broke up after this.
Yeah.
That this was the last album they made. Because the album ends with Jeff Magnum sitting up.
Yeah, yeah. The ending, this is the exact opposite of One, where the ending is like him setting down the guitar and then literally standing up and walking away. And I think that is so, so good.
It's great. So, like, I feel like my relationship with so much media becomes too much of an attachment that it becomes difficult when I realize it's ending. Like, Arthur ended, and I was in shock.
Yeah.
Arthur had started before I was born and was going for my whole life until it just ended. There's a ton of things like that where they ran for forever and I took it for granted. Like, Adventure Time, when that ended, even though that, you know, began while I was well into my life, when it ended, I was still like, wow, that's the end of it, huh? There's no more. And I feel like with music artists, it's easy to be like, oh, I can't wait for their next album. You know, you'll listen to their most recent and it'll be like, oh, I can't wait to see what they do next, you know. But at the same time, people can't always be making music. Things will have to end at some point. And
yeah.
So don't hate the bands for breaking up. Even if they just released a, you know, stellar album, even if it was just an okay album, you know, like kind of the general critical reception was at the time for Airplane, was, you know, just like it has to end at some point. So instead of worrying about that loss or trying to hold on to it. You know, maybe letting yourself deal with the loss of media is a healthy way to prepare yourself for life.
Yeah, I think it's even more poignant, especially with music artists, because like things like shows, there will always be iconic voice actors and such like that, but like, you know, voice actors or actors in shows, they can have replacements.
That's easy for you to say.
Sometimes. I mean, Arthur went through multiple different voice actors for their characters.
Sure.
Or like, you know, Sesame Street is going to go through and will go through multiple different, like, people who are Big Bird or whatever.
Sure.
But, like, music artists are, like, you know, especially if you find, like, solo artists and stuff, they have exactly the same finite amount of time on this earth that you do, you mm-hmm. know? Like it's even more kind of specific with stuff like that, with stuff like, you know, specific bands or specific, like, authors, stuff like that, where, mm-hmm. you know, these are people who are kind of irreplaceable within whatever they specifically do.
Mm-hmm. Though, I mean, that's still kind of rude to voice actors.
Then, listen, yeah, I'm not...
Like, can you imagine Animaniacs without Rob Paulson?
That's fair. I'm not... Listen, you're 100% correct. I'm just saying that, like, theoretically, you could syndicate past, like, the original voice actor.
Mm-hmm.
The only voice actor that I will ever be rude to is Steven Crowder.
Yeah.
The famous voice of the Brain and nothing else.
And nothing else. The Brain wasn't even in the finale. What happened to him? Is he just like a brain cell?
These liberals are talking about police reform, so I got my friend DW on the show to talk about what the police are really like.
God, DW being a cop was such a good joke. Such a good bit. This is now just the Arthur corner where we talk about Arthur.
Yeah.
You ever realize how fucking manipulative DW is? All right.
So that's In the Airplane Over the Sea.
Solid 7 out of 10.
Yeah. Finally, we've become Mew ourselves. We're now so snobby, even the top Mew album is a 7 out of 10 for us.
Fuck, we should have started this episode with Net the Knee Surf Tano here. The internet's busiest music podcast.
I can understand why it is like the top tier Mew album, because it is excellent and 40% of it is completely unlistenable. And I mean that in varying amounts of positivity and negativity, but mostly positive.
Mm-hmm. Mostly positive ratings on Steam. Thank you for listening. You can give us a mostly positive rating by commenting and liking and, you know, giving us a review on any podcasting platform you like. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at NetSurferPro. We post teasers for upcoming episodes. I need to figure out what the next teaser is going to look like, but this one I was pretty proud of. It was a crown, a carrot, and a flower.
Nice, nice.
You know, I could have done milk, but I didn't want to bother with trying to find an emoji to represent neutral.
Hang on, wait. Obviously, this is the outro, but I'm going to help you here. So, box, 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 milk, hotel, box, box, box,
good.
Box.
It's pretty good.
True anyway.
Neutral milk hotel. Yeah, you can follow us on any podcasting platform you like to get updates on when our new episodes come out. You can also follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I tweet links to anything I'm working on, retweet NetSurferPro, retweet my other podcast, Board Game Bros. I stream and I that tweet out links to when I go live. I've been streaming on twitch.tv/twack, and I've been streaming a lot of La Mulana 2. Fantastic game. Don't recommend it because it is wild and brain-hurty, but it's a great game, great time. Come check that out. You can follow me on YouTube at youtube.com/user/ie.sonic, Or if you look up Twack's Playthroughs, my second channel, which there's a link to from my Twitter, you can find our playthroughs of things when we upload them, as well as our Nira tier list video, which has been glowing reviews. A YouTube commenter said it was an important tier list.
Yes.
So check that all out.
Meanwhile, you can find me at Twitter and also at TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWLS0N. I post my hot takes, and I've had a pretty good track record with TikTok the past couple of times I've uploaded a video. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where one of these days I will upload a video, I swear it. And you can also find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire on Twitch, where I genuinely might actually stream because the new Stanley Parable Ultra Deluxe is coming out, and goddammit, I want to play it, and I might actually stream it. So who knows? If you feel like looking up that, then go ahead and give me, you know, a look up there. But aside from that, that's all my socials. Thank you very much for listening.
Do you ever think that the reason why DW became a cop is literally because a snowball melted one time?